From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Thousands of pages of documents related to the first John Doe probe are released. We'll examine the most important of them. Then we'll learn about efforts to improve the health of Milwaukee's rivers.
Where we like to see a downward trajectory in a lot of our pollutants, we're seeing upward ones.
Plus why the Betty Brin Children's Museum partnered with the Forest Service on a new exhibit.
In our peer industry, there was a lack for environmental education. So for us to be able to introduce the Smoky Bear and Woodsy Owl, messages behind that, and integrate that into an interactive exhibit for young children was a huge opportunity.
And Milwaukee's gospel quartet, Queens of Harmony, get ready to take the stage at the Pabst Theater.
We work hard at what we do. Now it kind of comes a little bit easier because we've been doing it for so long.
It's all coming up on Lake Effect, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Documents released yesterday indicate Governor Scott Walker was aware of a secret parallel email system that was in place during his time as Milwaukee County Executive. The thousands of documents are related to the first so-called John Doe investigation into campaign activities. They include many conversations between Walker's taxpayer-supported county staff and his campaign staff as he first ran for governor in 2010. Among the most significant is an email from Walker's administration director to aide Kelly Reinflesch, noting that the secret email system allowed her to communicate regularly with then-County Executive Walker and his chief of staff. Reinflesch was the only person in the probe convicted of illegally conducting campaign business while on county time. Other county staffers who were charged with responding to open records requests at the time were reportedly unaware of the system. Mordecai Lee is a professor of governmental affairs at UW-Milwaukee's School of Continuing Education. He talked with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke about the most significant revelations from the thousands of documents that were released on Wednesday.
Well, we have to start at square one in the sense that the prosecutor had those 27,000 pages all along, and the prosecutor decided not to charge the person who is now the governor. And that indicates that while the governor's name comes through in some of those documents, and there's at least one email from the governor, that they did not see prosecutable evidence. And so I think when Scott Walker yesterday said, look, this is something that happened 3 to 4 years ago. This went through a legal process. It was then closed. I think he has a point to make that it's sort of fun to read those documents, especially for political junkies, to really see the inside of a campaign. But whether there is anything new here, the governor is right. There is nothing new here.
Is there anything in and of itself illegal about the existence of this separate email system?
It's possible, although, again, all the charges have already been filed. But here was a situation where they were bending over backwards to use technology so that theoretically any emails they were sending were not in the public domain. They were not on their county computers. They were not on their county email address. So it was definitely a situation to try to hide something. Now, as it turns out, the prosecutor, without too much problem, said that a subpoena applied to everything they did when they were in their county offices, and quickly they found out about this. So there clearly was an intent to evade the scope of public records and public meetings, but in the end it failed.
Well, and at the heart of this was this idea that there were people that were mixing county business with campaign business, and that, we should note, is illegal. But the issue seems to be whether Scott Walker, as county executive, was aware of it, not whether he was actually engaged in doing it himself.
Mitch, you've really gotten to the heart of some of the issues, and some of them are about crimes, and some of them are about sort of political missteps that may or may not end up being big deals. But I think we have to clarify that the law is understandable in principle, that when we as the taxpayers pay for somebody's time and we buy them a computer and we give them an email address, that they can only use it for official business. So if you want to parse it closely, when they go home at night and they're on their personal computer, they can do campaign work. They just can't do it on the taxpayer's dollar. And what we're seeing from these emails clearly is there were campaign-related activities while they were in the office, while they were using county computers. And there was extensive coordination with the campaign. And I realize that some people are saying they're shocked and appalled that there's coordination between an incumbent's office and a campaign for another office. But, you know, when Barack Obama was running for re-election, there clearly was coordination between the White House and his Chicago campaign office. So to a certain extent, I think we have to withhold the shocked and appalled reaction with the realities of what it is to campaign for another office.
Well, and speaking as someone who has been in elected office and has had to seek election as well, I mean, how realistic is it to even expect that there not be any coordination? I mean, just from a logistical standpoint, it seems kind of impossible to imagine that there would not be some kind of coordination between an elected office and a campaign staff.
You're right, Mitch, and it's sort of hard to draw the finest of fine lines because, for example, if they had an 8 a.m. daily conference call, how are we going to handle some issues? Who's going to handle what? I think that's okay. Presumably, these were not two-hour-long conference calls. These were just sort of touch base, get everything clear for the day. I think that's really okay. When people start raising their eyebrows, it's how much was his official office doing things deliberately molded by the campaign's needs? And again, we should not be naive about these things. But on the other hand, we would not want a campaign manager telling county officials what to do because it's convenient to the campaign.
We should also note that there is a distinction often between what's unethical and what's illegal.
That's a fabulous point. And I think the fallout that happens over the next couple of days is going to be based on that distinction. In other words, Governor Walker can clearly say, this is a closed John Doe. I was not a target. I was not indicted. There was no crime here. But you're right. There's a kind of a political standard that is slightly different. And you know, back in the Watergate days, and I'm not implying in any way that this is Watergate.
It's a loaded comparison, but it's a useful parallel.
And the parallel comes from Howard Baker, who was a Republican of Tennessee, a member of the Watergate Committee, and he framed it perfectly. He said, what did he know and when did he know it? And I think right now we're seeing this being applied to Chris Christie about Bridgegate. And so if we were to take the worst case scenario, using the standard of what did he know and when did he know it, it appears that Governor Walker sort of knew about the intense coordination and sort of knew about the special email network. But are we going to say that therefore he must have known that there were laws and crimes being committed, that he must have known X? And up to now, he's got ice in his veins. You know, up to now, he says, I had a policy. They weren't supposed to do campaign work on office time. And he really leaves it at that.
Well, from a legal standpoint, it seems that there – if I get what you're saying correctly, there's not necessarily a legal smoking gun here. But that does not necessarily mean and obviously doesn't mean that this won't show up in a political sense during the governor's reelection campaign.
You've really hit it on the head in the sense of what accusations get traction. And I think we have to realize that Governor Walker is a very skilled politician and he's practically a Teflon politician. And it seems to me when the Democrats – let's say they're running a 30-second ad. It's October. They're trying to pull the worst they can out of this cache of documents. So they're accusing him of what? Of he wasn't a good manager, that he didn't oversee his people well, or – they ignored his policy of not engaging in campaign work on office time. Would that stick? Would that say to a voter, gee, I was going to vote for Scott Walker, but now that I'm hearing this ad, I'm going to vote against him? I'm guessing it's not going to change a lot of people's minds.
It is fairly easy to imagine the campaign commercials between now and then, though.
Absolutely. When you're in politics, you do whatever it takes to win. And so yesterday we saw the Republican Governors Association run a flat-out attack ad on Mary Burke. And we can assume that the same things will be done by Democrats against Governor Walker sometimes quoting from these emails.
Is there any kind of damage control that you think that the governor needs to do in the short run? You know, to go back to the Chris Christie comparison, there were people he could fire. But in this case, the people that are involved in this were working on his campaign or with his county executive office 4 or more years ago.
You know, this is really interesting because Governor Christie fired some people and then he started attacking the key witness against him. I think David Wildstein, if I'm saying it right. Notice that Governor Walker has disassociated himself from any violations of the law, but he hasn't denounced those staffers. And I think in the political world, one can see that they're showing a loyalty to him in the way that he's reciprocating by not denouncing them as sort of the scum of the earth kind of thing. And I think this shows us what a skilled politician he is. And think of what happened yesterday morning. Yesterday morning, he did a media availability just before the documents were released. And he he didn't run from the cameras, you know, and he said right into the microphones, he said, this is something that a county employee did about 3-4 years ago and the legal processes ended about a year ago. And that shows that he knew he had to give them a soundbite because otherwise they just hound him forever for a soundbite. But he did it just before he had to talk about any individual document. And in a sense, that was his response. And that shows you what a sort of fleet-footed politician he is.
There was one other interesting revelation. There are probably several more, but there are a lot of documents and we haven't gone through all of them. But one of the other interesting revelations in the documents was the apparent animosity that Walker and his staff had towards the person who would become the lieutenant governor. Does that have any traction, any significance at this stage of the game?
That's a fabulous point, and now we can move away from scandal mongering and talk about good government. And you know, the model we have for presidential nominees, so for example, Mitt Romney, that after he became the Republican nominee, he picked somebody to be his running mate. He wanted somebody simpatico with him. And in Wisconsin, we have this very bizarre system of not following that template. Instead, there's a primary for governor on the Republican and Democratic side, and then there's a separate primary for lieutenant governor. And so sometimes people get paired with other people they're not simpatico with. And the documents are showing us that he was vaguely in a slate with State Representative Davis. He wanted Davis to win. Davis did not win. Clefish won. And I think we should say that it's in the interest of good government that a governor gets to choose who their lieutenant governor is instead of this crazy independent primary approach.
And so is the lasting impact of that part of the document release that things are just more awkward between the governor and the lieutenant governor?
Well, both of them are very skilled politicians and professional public personas. And so they clearly are not at war. She clearly declared loyalty to him and she's doing exactly what he wants. And so she's a member of the team, as has happened in several other situations in Wisconsin politics. But that he didn't want her is sort of fun to talk about because it does get to the silliness of having separate primaries for lieutenant governor.
Mordecai Lee, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Occasional news analyst Mordecai Lee is professor of governmental affairs at UWM's School of Continuing Education. He spoke with Mitch Tyke about yesterday's release of the first John Doe probe documents. Coming up next, we'll learn about efforts to improve the health of Milwaukee's rivers. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz reports next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. The health of Milwaukee's rivers is improving, albeit slowly. In early January, the third annual report card from the group Milwaukee River Keeper gave the quality of the Milwaukee River Basin a C-. It's a low score, but actually a slight improvement over the D-plus given to the 900 square miles of the Kinnickinnick, Menominee, and Milwaukee River watersheds. The authors of the report point to a chronic water quality impairment, thanks in part to remnants of legacy contaminants released before the Clean Water Act was crafted. There are actually several area organizations who are actively monitoring river quality and seeking to improve the letter grade on the next report card, as WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz reports.
Cheryl Nunn coordinates more than 80 volunteers who troll the Milwaukee, Menominee, and KK watersheds. Milwaukee Riverkeeper started the Citizen Monitoring Program back in 2006. Adding some standardization where little existed.
We have a multi-structured program where we bring in volunteers kind of at an introductory level and train them how to use more simple equipment and in kind of the biology and the techniques that are necessary. And then we elevate them to an advanced program. And in that program, people are using essentially DNR equivalent equipment and DNR protocols. And they even get a login where they can put their data directly into the DNR database. So we set up several years setting up the program, and then in 2010 decided, you know, we need to do a much better job of actually disseminating that information to the public and trying to make it understandable what we're finding in the river, what the river's telling us, and what they can do to help us get to where we want to be, which is, you know, a clean, fishable, swimmable river.
Nunn acknowledges that the challenge of conveying the complexity of the basin's water quality is made even trickier because the most up-to-date report reflects data from 2 years ago.
We've had some people wondering why it's taking so long, why we haven't released the 2013. And it kind of goes to what I was talking about before. It takes us a while to do quality assurance on the data to make sure that the data is correct. We also, in addition to our citizen data, we do collect DNR data, as well as MMSD data. And MMSD also goes through a long process to make sure that their data is accurate.
How do you check that?
Part of it is just making sure what's in the system matches up with what's in the data sheet that was taken in the field. Part of it on our end is also visiting our volunteers with redundant sets of equipment to make sure that when they're going out there, in a lot of cases with meters, you know, looking at oxygen and pH, and that we're getting the same result.
Nunn says looking back at 2012, the basin's baby step improvement from D+ to C- likely resulted from an extremely dry summer rather than human effort.
In a lot of different ways, the water quality was improved, I think, because of the drought.
Why would drought improve the water quality?
Oh, that's a good question. So in a lot of our really urban watersheds in particular, they're very dominated by urban runoff. So basically stormwater that's running off the street and, you know, off of our yards and our homes and, you know, going into the storm drains and then dumping into the river. And so when there is less runoff, because we don't have a lot of rain, there's a lot less urban runoff into the river. So I think that partially explains why we saw improvement.
Nunn is quick to add, Milwaukee's three watersheds continue to be hit by multiple pollutants, including phosphorus.
And phosphorus comes from fertilizers. A lot of that has actually been phased out of residential fertilizers now, but the farmers still are able to use phosphorus in their fertilizers and in some cases golf courses. Even in a drought year, you know, we would have thought or hoped actually that we would have saw some, you know, improvements in phosphorus because there wasn't as much rain. But we still had, you know, a lot of major phosphorus problems in 2012. And I think some of that is because, you know, there's still a lot of it just in the system that's like hanging out in the sediments. And the rivers in a lot of cases, because there wasn't rain, were warmer than normal. And so that did cause a lot of nuisance algae blooms in 2012 that I have to say were pretty significant. We had a really significant algae problem on the lower Menominee, which I think a lot of people will remember, probably the worst I've seen in 12 years, where we like to see a downward trajectory and a lot of our pollutants, we're seeing upward ones.
Bacteria levels from human waste, Nunn says, are up. Suspended solids, such as sediment and other debris, threatens critters that live in streams and the streams themselves. Nunn says you can see its culprit on our snow-covered urban landscape.
You know, a lot of times in the spring and the summer, you don't notice it as much because it rains and all that stuff washes down the drains and goes right into the waterways. You know, when you really drive down the street right now, you just see the blackness that's out there and how really, you know, gross the roads get and the sidewalks and everything. You know, a lot of that dirt's coming just from the land. You know, it's coming from urban land uses. You know, a very high percentage in the Milwaukee Basin is construction, huge loads of sediment in construction sites that aren't well managed and maintained. And in some cases in the upper Milwaukee, still quite a lot of sediment from agricultural use as well.
But Nunn says there are positive stories. Upstream, banks are being stabilized, while downstream, stretches of cement channels are being removed. A regulatory framework is also in the works that Nen says will put our rivers on a pollution diet. It's called TMDL.
It means total maximum daily load, a federally approved plan that's binding by law, basically saying, okay, we're not meeting standards for phosphorus, and we're not meeting standards for bacteria, and we're not meeting standards for sediment. As part of that effort, we've really been able to target where there needs to be pollutant reductions in different portions of the river to meet these standards. There's a lot of different groups, the DNR and MMSD and a lot of different stakeholders that have been working on these TMDLs along with a lot of nonprofits to come up with these plans. So entities that do discharge pollutants into the river, whether it's a municipality or a company, are going to get new limits put into their permits eventually that will help us ratchet this pollution down. I think that's really exciting. So over time, we'll be able to really focus our money and our efforts to reducing the pollutants to get them to a level where, we think they're going to be safe to be used.
As the TMDL program rolls out, Nen says Milwaukee Riverkeepers volunteers will continue to test and monitor their assigned stretch of the basin. She takes the long view on the time it might take to transform the Milwaukee River Basin to a fishable, swimmable state. So, too, does Kimberly Gleffy with the River Revitalization Foundation, or RRF. Her office sits at the southern edge of a community-driven effort to create 870 acres of trails and restored habitat called the Milwaukee River Greenway. She says its implementation will stretch out for decades, but Gleffy already feels its cumulative effects.
Every improvement we make in the river valley will improve water quality. So I think Riverkeeper's report card and River Revitalization Foundation's land restoration, habitat restoration and shoreline restoration is only going to enhance habitat and improve the water quality of the river.
RRF's most recent tangible step is a one-mile stretch of path.
We received an easement from Milwaukee Area Technical College where their solar farm is. And once we had the easement recorded, then we went in, we had to do a trail design and get the permit from the DNR, and then we went in with Student Conservation Association and volunteers and students to actually physically construct the trail.
The process stretched out over 2 years.
Probably the longest amount of time is negotiating an easement and getting that all approved legally. Once you have the easement and all the permits, the trail was constructed in like a month.
Aaron Zaleski has just come on board to help take the Greenway vision a step or two further.
Implementing signage, working with landowners to close gaps in the trails, working towards a habitat plan and doing ecological restoration and coordinating that throughout the whole 800 plus acres.
Meanwhile, conservation biologist Gary Casper is working to regenerate wildlife hard hit before the river's revitalization. Casper specializes in amphibians and reptiles. He started taking inventory of snakes on the Milwaukee River over 6 years ago, but says he's learned a lot since.
Well, first of all, there's only three species, which is not good. I mean, there should be more. So things like water snakes have disappeared from the riverway, but potentially could be brought back. So the snakes we are finding are the Butler's garter snake, the common garter snake, and the brown snake. And these are typical urban snakes that are pretty tolerant of development and manage to persist. But in this situation, the Butler's garter snakes outnumber everybody else. Then the brown snakes and the common garters are real rare. So we've marked, several hundred garter snakes, and we're learning more about their movement patterns, how long they live, how fast they grow.
Casper also implanted about 40 garters with reflector tags he tracks with radar.
So we were able to walk around with this radar unit and try to find the blips, and we're finding snakes in situations that we had never found them in before.
Including in the woods, rather than the grass, where they're normally found. And they're feeding on things that are affected by water pollution.
Well, the Butlers eat almost exclusively earthworms.
Okay.
Which in this situation are probably highly contaminated with toxic sediments that they eat. So it's been interesting to see how the snakes can feed on this contaminated earthworms and still have good population.
Snakes, of course, are just one piece of the ecological puzzle Casper looks at from two endpoints. What did the habitat look like before Milwaukee became Milwaukee, and compare it to what's left today, with an eye toward creating a habitat plan?
Try to figure out what we can do to improve things, increase biodiversity, get some more of these species that people really like to have around actually living and breeding here. So like with the frog community, went from, we suspect, 8 species pre-settlement to 2 today. Salamanders went from, we suspect, 4 species pre-settlement to none today. So those are groups of organisms that we could reestablish. There's just certain things that have to be done to support them, which aren't here right now.
So what would have to be done, Gary?
Well, with the amphibians mainly, it's about getting some of these wetlands back, especially the temporary isolated wetlands that they breed in. There's a few spots we've started to identify where it seems feasible, but it'll take stakeholders to come together and make it happen.
It makes you wonder what kind of impact Casper's vision would have on a future report card. For Like Effect, I'm Susan Benz.
Susan Benz is WUWM's environmental reporter. She spoke with conservation biologist Gary Casper, Kimberly Gleffy and Aaron Zaleski of the River Revitalization Foundation, and Cheryl Nen with Milwaukee Riverkeeper. We'll take a short break now, and when we return, the U.S. Forest Service and the Betty Brin Children's Museum join forces to encourage kids to get outside. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. The last 2 days excepted, this winter's been so cold it's been hard to wait for a bus outside, let alone plan an outdoor adventure. And for kids, that's meant a lot of time cooped up indoors. But an exhibit recently opened at the Betty Brin Children's Museum aims to get kids excited enough about the natural environment that they'll want to head outdoors when spring finally sets in for good. It's the second time the Smoky Bear and Woodsy Owl Home Sweet Home exhibit has been on display here. It started as a local initiative with the U.S. Forest Service, but it was successful enough that the exhibit went out to other museums around the country. Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke met up at the exhibit with Kristen Adams, Chief Advancement Director at the Betty Brin Museum, and with Gene Klassen, who heads up the U.S. Forest Service's Urban Connections Program in Milwaukee. While Smoky Bear and Woodsy Owl are icons to people of a certain age, Klassen talked about whether kids in 2014 hold them in the same esteem.
Well, that was part of this idea of the exhibit, too, was to kind of reintroduce a new generation to the characters Smoky Bear and Woodsy Owl. And certainly a lot of the parents do know, and so they loved the characters when they were growing up, and they wanted to introduce their kids to Smoky and Woodsy.
Well, so talk about how this partnership evolved. Where did it begin?
Well, I think we both had a dialogue going. It was kind of started off more as a local level. How can we partner locally? We're physically, our buildings are right across the street from each other, up the block. And on the museum's end, we just started an initiative. It was an exhibit development initiative where we had been renting educational exhibits from other institutions across the country. And we just felt they weren't highly interactive. And there were some things that we felt were missing. So we started doing that on our own. And one thing we did realize in our peer industry, there was a lack for environmental education. So for us to be able to introduce the Smoky Bear and Woodsy Owl, the messages behind that, and integrate that into an interactive exhibit for young children was a huge opportunity for us. So our interest was there. We had just started the initiative. This was our second national traveling exhibit project. And the U.S. Forest Service was kind enough to partner with us.
Well, and where did you start? How did you set about to bring the message that you already do for an older audience to younger people?
We had several meetings, and we would come with our key messages that we would like to share. You know, our goal of our Urban Connections program is to connect urban residents to the Forest Service. And some of our key messages, of course, are, you know, getting outside, trying new recreation opportunities, going camping, hiking. So it just felt like whatever key message we wanted the museum to share, they found a really fun, creative way to share it with this age group.
We're not ordering something on Amazon. This is something we created together. So developing those ideas, and for us, it really translated into a physical experience of a pretend woodland, urban, and stream setting. So kids are really coming into what looks like an outdoor experience replicated indoors. And it's 1,500 square feet. It's highly interactive. There's close to 100 interactive activities to do. And we feel really proud that we were able to communicate those messages from Smoking Woodsy in a really interactive way.
And, you know, for example, the idea of one thing we want to share with our urban audiences is the career opportunities with the Forest Service. So, you know, again, thinking, well, there's probably not a way to share that with this age group, but they came up with these little uniforms that the kids can wear, you know, a little smoky hat, and they get so excited about pretending they're, you know, a biologist or a cartographer or different careers.
We really wanted families to be inspired to head outdoors.
It would be a mistake to, right. to say
Absolutely.
That this is going to replicate the outdoors.
So a lot of people have asked, you know, is this an outdoor experience? No, it is not. But we certainly want the takeaway to be to, you know, if you can get up northern Wisconsin to the fabulous forests that we have here, if you can get to your local parks, head to your backyard. Nature is so important to the healthy development of children and for us as human beings. So it's so important for them to connect with nature. Secondly, we wanted to make sure that Smokey's, you know, safety messages and Woodsy Owl's conservation messages were clearly communicated and really inspire children to become stewards of the land. We want them to understand that there are simple and easy ways that you and your family, so even if mom and dad isn't doing it, you can also remind mom and dad to shut off the water faucet. Hey, maybe we should put a rain barrel in our backyard. Let's plant a little tree together. These are wonderful family activities that everyone can do, and inspiring them to take some responsibility when they're at home or when they're out exploring nature. And for the Children's Museum, our final objective was really to ensure that early learning experiences, which help children to develop important social, academic, and physical skills, were integrated in the activities. So we based everything on Wisconsin and national academic standards, as well as early learning standards. So I think having that all come together, we're really, really proud.
Now, if I understand correctly, after this was at Betty Brin in 2009, it went on the road. Has it changed at all since the time it first premiered?
Well, it's changed in that 700,000 people have experienced it. So because of that, you know, when it was built, I mean, it was built not only using green materials and sustainable materials. The design and the build was really well thought out. But it's built for safety and security and durability. So we had anticipated about a four-year tour, and we are now at that mark. But thanks to the U.S. Forest Service, we've received a new grant that will enable us to refurbish, maintain, and integrate some new messages. I know that it's important to the Forest Service, as well as the museum, to perhaps expand on the career opportunities. So that's one thing that we're going to be looking at. But really, you know, maintaining and making sure that it's durable enough to withstand another 4 years. So that wonderful opportunity will extend the tour till 2016. It's already been to 12 science centers, children's museums, natural history museums across the United States. So it'll extend that tour.
When you design an exhibit like this, do you test market it on kids before it becomes a full-fledged exhibit? Are kids involved in the planning process?
It depends on the activity. Yes, we do. Sometimes we just bounce ideas off of kids. Sometimes we'll take a prototype and invite them into our shop and in a controlled setting and let them play or tinker around. And, you know, sometimes we use ideas from activities that we know are tried and true here and that we change it up or replicate it in some way that we know is going to be valuable for this experience.
And so in this case, was that part of the process?
Yes. And it's a good one. It does take time, though. We had 2 years to do that. So being able to prototype some things, the real prototyping really doesn't happen until the full experience comes together. It is a brand new thing. So what we do is we have education staff, we have exhibit staff for any brand new opening that are scheduled, and we are here and we are watching. Kids do not play with things that you'd intended, or they find new, creative, wonderful ways to explore activities. And they put props in strange places throughout the exhibit. So it's really a test period for us once it's up and running. That's why we always premiere an exhibit here, so that if there's any changes that we need to make in the exhibit experience, that happens here before it leaves and goes on the road.
From the Forest Service perspective, how do you know that you've done it right?
That's a good question. I think certainly the the numbers that Kristen has shared, you know, the number of museums and science centers it's been to across the country, the number of kids and families that it's reached, the publicity, the sharing of the messages that has gone through different, you know, Forest Service channels and different media outlets. So we were so pleased with the exhibit, and just I'm amazed at how they were able to make messages like energy fun and the water cycle. I mean, it just every element was just so creatively done and so much fun for kids when you watch them play with the different activities.
Well, and so give us some examples of what's actually here and how you turned that message into something that's interactive and fun for kids to play with. Let's say the energy and the water cycle.
Sure. For that, we have in our urban setting, we have a pretend house that kids can step into. There is an activity where we hear, and I don't know if our listeners can hear it, but we have a dripping faucet, and that can equate into about 50 gallons a day in wasted water. So there is an audio prompt that comes on that tells kids, let's turn that water off, and then when they do turn the faucet, it gives them a congratulatory message saying, good job. We have a generator activity, a hand-cranked generator, where kids have to use their own power to crank it, and then we have a radio, a fan, a light that they can experiment. How much energy does it really take? And then, you know, there's the takeaway from that, it's a lot, so let's conserve it and let's be thoughtful about turning our lights off. We also have a woodsy recycling activity in there, which is very, very popular. We have a pretend kitchen setting so that they can take the paper and the glass and the metal items, the cans, they can sort them in our kitchen. That's also a great pre-math activity, matching and sorting, putting them in the appropriate bin, and we tried to make it fun for actually getting them to restock those wonderful materials, because that's always the challenge. On the outside of the house, we have opportunities for them to work and put some recycled materials for insulation. We have some recycled denim and newspaper materials. We have some recycled shingles that they can put up, so they get to do a little bit of carpentry work here using some recycled materials. And, you know, that was also integrating the exhibit, we used water-based paints and toxic-free paints, as well as in the house, we also have countertops made out of crushed sunflower seeds. It is very cool. So just in that one small component, you can see that we really jam-packed a lot of activities to try and get those conservation messages across.
The water cycle activity you can see over here with Woodsy Owl, it actually, they utilize golf balls as water droplets, and so the kids have them go up, and it comes down as the rain goes across the roof and through the different stages into the rain barrel and then into the garden, and it really is a creative way to show kids how the water cycle works.
It is something to be able to experience this during a winter that has often been so cold that you would not want to be outside.
We're both laughing. Yes, it is. It has been really, it's been a brutal winter. We're hardy here in Wisconsin, but I will say, you know, on our end, I think the museum has been a great resource for not only families, but educators who are looking to expand or complement their classroom curriculum. We just had 110 kids here this morning through three different school groups, and we have families with young children playing here today. So we know it's a great opportunity. I know we all know spring is around the corner, and our wonderful pretend trees here are reminding everyone of that.
And the fishing boat.
Yes.
Things to look forward to get outdoors.
Exactly. Well, thanks to both of you, and best of luck with this exhibit and going forward.
Thank you so much, Mitch.
Thank you, Mitch.
Kristen Adams is the Chief Advancement Director at the Betty Brin Children's Museum. Jean Klassen is with the U.S. Forest Service's Urban Connections Program in Milwaukee. They spoke with Mitch Teich at the exhibit Smokey Bear and Woodsy Owl, Home Sweet Home, which is open at the museum until May 4th. You can see pictures at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break, and then Milwaukee Gospel Quartet, the Queens of Harmony, join us in the studio ahead of their Friday night performance at the Pabst Theater. Lake Effect returns with that in just a moment on WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. That's the sound of Milwaukee's own Queens of Harmony. The gospel quartet has been singing in Central City churches for almost half a century, and they have also performed in Washington, D.C., and as far away as Japan. But this Friday evening, Milwaukee Gospel Jubilee at the Pabst brings together five of Milwaukee's great gospel groups for an evening of celebration, and the Queens will perform on the Pabst Theater stage for the first time. The Queens of Harmony are a quartet, but there are five members of the group. One singer sits out each song so that each voice gets a chance to rest. The current group is Jesse McCollum, Julia Love Brown, Dorothy Ivory, Deborah Estelle, and Joyce Johnson. They, along with Milwaukee singer-songwriter and the Jubilee concert organizer John Seeger, joined me in the studio recently to chat and to perform a few songs. McCollum explained the history of the group.
We started 50 years ago, starting in August this year. Originally started about listening to the Masonic Wonders, and one of the ladies of the group asked us, why don't the Queens, you know, get a group together, and that's how we originally started singing.
Basically because the guys did it and you wanted to do it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Jesse's married to one of the Masonic Wonders, Charles McCollum.
Okay, that's of course why the
great singer.
Yeah, why the name is so familiar. Yeah. So 50 years ago, you've been singing ever since, but you're doing something slightly different than the Masonic Wonders in that most of the time you are a cappella, right?
Right.
Was that a decision you made early on?
No, that was a decision that our first manager, Miss Miller Wilson, had made for us just to start singing a cappella. So we started from there.
The other four of you are here. I know it's a quartet, and we'll explain the reason that there are five in a minute. But how did all the rest of you get involved, and how long have you been involved? Joyce, what about you?
Well, I've been involved going on 26 years now or something. How I got involved is that they used to rehearse at my mom's house, Dorothy. And I used to listen to them sing all the time. So one time, my TT here, Julia, she had to leave for going down south on a leave of absence because of sickness in the family. And she told me to take her place, and she was just kidding, though. But I wasn't kidding. I was like, okay. And I took her place, and when she came back, I was like, you got another place because I'm here in your place, so you got the other place. And I've been here ever since.
And Julia, was that okay?
That was fine. That was perfectly fine with me. You know, I was so happy to see that she had really taken such an interest in actually becoming a member of the Queens of Harmony. So it was great for me when I came back to see her indulging in the group and singing and just being there to learn as much as she could. And she's been here, like she said, about 26 years, so.
And Dorothy, for you to have your daughter in, that must be nice.
Right.
And when did you first start with the group? And actually, Julia, I didn't even get when you started.
Oh, well, I've been singing for about 35 years.
With this group?
With this group.
Wow.
Yes.
And for you, ma'am?
About 32 years, I think,
in all. And how did you meet? Did you meet in church?
No, I learned from my aunt. And I came, I moved here in 77, and one of the ladies that was with them at that time asked me, do you like to sing? And I said, yeah. And she said, well, you want to come sing with us? Which I did. And I've been with them ever since, really. It's a great group. I just like singing. I've been singing since I was five.
And Deborah, for you.
Yes.
When did you first get involved?
I've been with the group about 30 years. I started singing when I was about three in church. I used to sing along, do duets with our mom. Unlike our sister here, my sister, she started singing when she was 19. She used to be kind of bashful, but I've never been bashful. I sang all through high school and church, and I just like to sing. I love music, any and all types, all genres.
Listen, I'm on my way to glory land.
Oh, I'm on my way to glory.
Two songs, and how do you arrange them? How does that all come about?
Well, if we hear a song that we like, it doesn't matter if it's the quartet or a choir song, we just arrange it to our voice, and we just sing it. We rehearse on it and sing it.
Do you ever have any difficulties coming up with the arrangements? Are there artistic differences?
Oh, yes. That does come about from time to time, you know. But we kind of like work it until we get it to fit us. We basically have the three-part harmony for the background. You know, we get the harmony. It's usually really easy for the lead singer because, you know, the background is kind of what pushes the lead singer on. And a lot of songs that we do, the lead singer can just ad lib and the background can like kind of just take it on and make it flow really easily. But we work hard at what we do. Now it kind of comes a little bit easier because we've been doing it for so long, you know. And we have such wonderful people like Mr. Seeger here who always encourages us and tell us we're kind of like some of the best at what we do. So that's a great plus.
That's always nice.
I paid her to say that.
So, John, now how did you get involved with these ladies?
I've been stalking Queens of Harmony for quite a while. I met them through the Masonic Wonders, and I got involved with them because their bass player asked me to stop by. They're looking for somebody to fill in on guitar, and I wound up doing a lot of these programs at the churches, and it's an astounding education for me. I grew up, I don't know if these ladies know, but I grew up Catholic when there was a Latin Mass based on Gregorian chant. Mm-hmm.
So this is a little different.
It's way different. I was an altar boy. So, you know, I had to learn all that Latin. It's not even close, you know. Music has come a long way.
It definitely has.
From Gregorian chant to Queens of Harmony.
Now, for this event that's coming up, this is a really amazing evening that is sort of a celebration of Milwaukee gospel. And you are a key part of it. How long has this been in the works? Were you invited or were you one of the ones that basically said, we need to do this?
Okay. I hate doing all the talking here, but
that's okay.
It was my idea.
Okay.
Yes, it was.
I'm on the board of Progressive Community Health Centers, and I've been telling everyone, a musician in a room with doctors and administrators and these super competent professionals sometimes feels a little lost. I felt like I wasn't really contributing. The day after one board meeting about a year and a half ago, my wife called me, my wife Lindsay, who's also working on this with us, to say, turn on the radio, Aretha Franklin's on. And I think she was being inducted into the Gospel Hall of Fame, although it seems kind of late for that because I was on your station. It connected in my mind. Progressive does wonderful things, and they're in the middle of a capital campaign building a new facility on 35th and Lisbon, expanding from like I think around 8,000 square feet to 42,000, and just a really great bunch of people. And who else helps in that part of the city is, you know, the Gospel Church is a big provider of care and spiritual counsel. And something popped in my head, and I said, Milwaukee Gospel. Mm-hmm. So the first person I called was Julia because she knows everybody in the gospel world.
So you're the connector.
I'm the connector, yes.
Yeah.
John and I, we sat down, and he and I talked about it, and we started from there. We were just so excited just to sit down and you know, just see this. And now that it's going to be manifested before us, it's just great because it's for a great cause. It's a great cause, and I'm really overwhelmed. I just can't wait, and I want everybody to come out and just be uplifted in the spirit with this event that's about to take place.
Well, and I know you ladies perform sometimes 3 and 4 times a day, depending on, you know, in different churches and different groups and that sort of thing. Is this the first time you've performed at the Pabst?
This will be the first time. The first time.
That's going to be fantastic.
Yeah, that's one of the really beautiful things about it is that I feel this is a culture that demands respect and has sort of been passed by a lot of the population at large. They don't get to see it. I mean, it's not on purpose all the time. The Pabst means respect. When they said yes, it was a big, big thing to us because, you know, I don't see a downside to paying respect to one of the really great traditions in America and helping out people who do need help. It's a win-win-win. I could keep going.
All the way around.
It really,
yeah, absolutely.
It looks like a beautiful thing.
Yes.
So many people talk about me, but I'm going on. So many people talk about me, but I'm going on. So many people talk about me, but I won't let that hinder me. I'm going on.
Oh, yeah.
With the Lord.
The Lord.
I'm going on.
Oh, yeah.
With the Lord.
Well, listen, sometimes I think my work is in vain, but I'm
going on.
Sometimes I feel my work
work is in vain, but I'm going on. Sometimes I feel my work is in vain, but I'm going on just the same.
I'm going on.
Oh, yeah.
With the Lord.
And I'm
going on.
Oh, yeah.
With the Lord.
Well, listen. Oh, Satan tried to turn me around, but
I'm going on.
Since you've been singing here for so long, what makes the Milwaukee gospel scene special? I mean, what makes it Milwaukee? Is there something in the way that you approach the music, something in the way that you perform it, that people who know gospel music are going to say, oh, yeah, they're from Milwaukee?
Everybody that's here based in Milwaukee knows that we have a sound that's kind of different from most.
Yeah, and that's why I'm asking, because it is.
It's quartet. When we were chose to go to D.C., we were chose out of a bunch of people, like 150-something. Everybody who's singing Milwaukee just about has to incorporate music. We incorporate music sometimes, too. We can sing with music, but the number one thing is that we sing quartet. We can sing without the music. We don't need the music.
Yeah. You don't need that backing.
Because our voices is the music.
Yeah. The Wisconsin Arts Board, you know, it's an art. What mm-hmm. we sing, they took it, and we never really just thought about it, that it was such an art.
Right.
And then when we got involved with the Wisconsin's Arts Board, and they showed us and took us different places, they took us to the Great Mall of Washington, D.C., where we performed out there on that Great Mall
Ooh.
For 15 days.
Mm-hmm.
15 days, two mm-hmm. sessions a day
mm-hmm.
for 15 days. During that time, they inducted us as members of the Smithsonian Institute. And after that great time, we went to Madison, and then all of a sudden, we got a chance to go to Chiba, Japan for 7 days. And we performed there. And believe you me, they say music is an international language. It is an international language. It was an experience where we performed before thousands of the Japanese people. And it was just glorious. You know, everybody was getting with us. We didn't speak the language, but it somehow the music kind of transcended, and everybody was up and just celebrating our music.
With you.
With us.
That must have been something.
And it is.
Yeah.
It was, and believe you me, it's an experience we'll always treasure. Always.
Well, I have a feeling that this concert you're going to treasure
oh, yes.
as well.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And I hope that this is the beginning of a long and fruitful relationship
oh, yeah.
that you have
right.
with the Pabst, because it seems to me that, as you're saying, that this is such a Milwaukee thing, this mm-hmm. particular quartet sound,
mm-hmm.
that we should be celebrating it and we should be getting
Absolutely.
It out there more.
Absolutely.
I'm so grateful that you guys were willing to come here.
Oh, thank you for having us. Thank you for inviting us.
And best of luck with the concert.
Oh,
are you
going to
come to the event?
I am.
All right.
You bet.
Great.
I wouldn't miss it. You're
going to get up and sing?
No. No. We want people to come back. We're going to go out with a song of yours, but while we do that, I want to say thank you all very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you.
The Queens of Harmony are Jesse McCollum, Julia Love Brown, Dorothy Ivory, Deborah Estelle, and Joyce Johnson. They, along with Milwaukee singer-songwriter John Seeger, join me in the studio. We heard excerpts from the two songs they performed for us, Glory Land and I'm Going with the Lord. And now we're hearing Roll Jordan Roll from their album Walk With Me, Lord. The Queens of Harmony take the stage at the Pabst Theater Friday night, along with the Masonic Wonders, Victory in Praise, Youth Choir, and the Genesis Singers, and the Sharon Travelers. Milwaukee Gospel Jubilee at the Pabst gets underway at 8 p.m., and all proceeds from the concert will go to Progressive Community Health Centers. And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. Lake Effect returns tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.